Cambridge 105.
Community radio in your city.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Flavour, covering all things food and drink related in and around Cambridge. With me, Matt Bentman.
Me, Ruth Reyes.
And me, Alan Alder. Coming up on today's programme, we investigate the factors involved in the price and availability of food, and what happens to those items that don't sell.
And we visit the Cambridge Food Cycle, part of the national UK charity that combines volunteers, surplus food and spare kitchen spaces to provide meals for those in poverty.
Food banks are also garnering increased media attention in the current climate. We visit one such food bank on Hills Road to find out more.
On a separate note, the recent heatwave has played a big part in demand for refreshments, and that brings long-established family business Verrecchia's Ice Cream under the flavour spotlight.
And in addition, we have Cambridge wine blogger Tom Lewis with some particularly amusing musings, and Alan will conclude today's show with his pick of the food and drink articles featured in today's newspapers. So let's begin.
We know from official figures that inflation is rising more quickly than take-home pay and that food price inflation is high. The result is that people who are already struggling are now finding it more and more difficult to afford to feed themselves and their families. Yet at this time of year there is a lot of food about. Fruit trees are laden, salad crops are abundant, carrots and cabbages are becoming ready to eat. So why aren't food shelves in shops groaning under the weight of cheap food? In fact, there is cheap food about, but other crops meant for human consumption are either not being harvested or are being fed to animals, not people. Brian from the farm shop in Lensfield Road, himself an ex-fruit farmer, explained it to me.
The classic one just recently is that there has been a massive overproduction of bananas. Bananas have been, which would normally change hands at about £20 a box, have been changing hands for as little as £1 a box. That's why in my shop I've been selling them for 50 pence a kilo. They're all sold now.
That was Brian from the farm shop in Lensfield Road, and he went on to explain that the availability of some foods is unpredictable from year to year.
Plums are a typical example. Last year there were virtually none. I don't know what the plum crop's going to be like this year, but plums can be massively overproduced, and I think that under those circumstances the big operators would steer clear of them. Because
but what happens to all of those plums? I mean, okay, you take some here, but we've got a lot more plums to sell off than we can handle, even the market stalls can handle.
I think they wouldn't get picked. I think that's what used to happen to us. We had nearly 50 acres of plums, and if you see that your plum crop is going to be very, very big, the first thing you have to do is lighten the burden on your trees, mm-hmm. otherwise they'll smash every branch of every plum tree. So you've got to still got to pick plums, but you've got to pick them and throw them away, just let them fall to the ground. But what would happen, because labour costs are a very significant part of food production, they wouldn't get picked. Cabbages, you mentioned cabbages would just get ploughed in. They would never ever go off the farm.
The situation is made more complex by the effect of the weather on our eating habits. We eat less lettuce when the sun goes in and use less white cabbage for making coleslaw. But the grower's lettuce and cabbage may be in a lorry headed for the supermarket. What happens then?
The traditional way, or the way that has grown up, is that farmers who grow fruit and vegetables, they have to hold hands with livestock farmers, and to a large degree, most vegetables can be fed to cattle, to pigs, to sheep, goats, so on, poultry. There are limitations to that, not all surplus vegetables can be fed to livestock. Potatoes are particularly difficult. Cabbages that you mention are particularly easy. Although the problem with that is that the major supermarkets invariably want the cabbage wrapped in cling film, so that every cabbage that you feed to a bullock has to have the cling film removed from it.
Right, so they're got from the field, they're packaged according to the way that the supermarket will want it. So the supermarket have ordered them.
Yes.
And then?
Well, they give you a ballpark figure. When we were growing apples and pears and plums and sending them to supply a major supermarket chain, they have a policy of turning around produce that is surplus to their requirements, and this is written into their contract. If you have a contract with them, they reserve the right to take all or none of what you send, and the upshot of that is that you have to be quick on your feet to be able to put it to some use.
So it doesn't ever get to the supermarket then?
Well, it gets to a middleman usually, right, or to a supermarket depot,
right,
at which point they will say, they will phone the grower, the producer, and say, you've sent us this quantity of, shall we say, plums. I had an instance last year where one of my neighbours produced some beautiful Victoria plums, absolutely superb. He is a very good fruit grower. And it was sent to the pack house of one of this country's best known supermarket chains, and they phoned him and said that the plums were too big and they wouldn't go through the machinery, they wouldn't go through the packing machinery that the supermarket chain cling film the plums in. And so because of that, he got a telephone call saying, would he come and collect them or should they throw them away? And if they threw them away, he would be expected to pay for the disposal of them. Because he's my neighbour and a friend of mine, and he knows we sell a lot of plums for our size in here, he phoned me and said, do I want any? I took about 100 boxes off him. They were absolutely superb Victoria plums. I had no trouble selling them. But he still had a couple of lorry loads left over, and he asked my advice, and I advised him to go to take them to the fruit and vegetable auction at Wisbeach, which still carries on to this day, and they were sold under the hammer, and at least he got something for them. And that is, any grower of fruit and vegetables will tell you a similar story.
Brian emphasised how food which is difficult to sell can be given to Food Cycle, an organisation that will then cook it and provide meals for people who are struggling. And Ruth has looked into this.
So let's start off by explaining, what is Food Cycle?
Food Cycle is a national charity, and it takes surplus food that would otherwise be going to waste, and then volunteers get together and turn it into a community meal for people suffering from food poverty.
Oh, that's awesome. So where do you get the surplus food? Like, who provides it?
So in Cambridge, every Friday we go to Sainsbury's on Sydney Street. We meet up with Outspoken Delivery, who are a green cycle courier company, and they are really awesome and they help us out every week. So we load up their bike trailer with food from Sainsbury's, and we also go to the Cambridge Farmers Outlet, which is on Lansfield Road. And then we take it by bike to the centre at St Paul's on Hills Road.
So tell me more about what might happen on a Saturday. What kind of people come?
So our guests that come along each week, we have a real mix actually. A real sort of good thing about Food Cycle is that it's not a soup kitchen, it's a community meal. So we invite people to come and sit down, tea and coffee is served to them, it's all table service, and the volunteers make sure they sit down and have a chat as well. And we have a real mix of people, so we have quite a lot of older people who, I think as much as anything else, just really enjoy the company and chatting to other people. We also have quite a lot of homeless people, and we have a very close relationship with Jimmy's Night Shelter and other places in Cambridge to make sure, you know, we're able to get in touch with them. And we invite anybody along, really. It's really open for all. Last week we fed half an orchestra who had a concert in the hall next door after the meal. So it's good to have a mix of people and really sort of build a little community around the meal. It's great.
Oh, that's really good. So, I mean, I know they have things like food boxes where they give similar people the raw ingredients. Do you think this is in any way maybe a little bit better or different because of the community aspect?
It's just a very different thing. Food Bank, which also operates from St Paul's, provides a really important service for people and an ever-increasing number of people who really need that help from them. And being able to take ingredients home which will last them for a few days or a week. I don't think they could ever replace each other, but having the community side of things, it brings so much added value to our meal. I was speaking to a lady from Jimmy's recently, and she said for a lot of the guys that come from there, it's as much about being treated in a normal way and being part of something as real human beings, because everybody is accepted and there's no hold-ups about where people come from. It's a really lovely open for everything community event.
Oh, that's brilliant. So tell me a bit more about the volunteer aspect. What kind of volunteers do you have? When do you need them?
So volunteering with Food Cycle is really good fun, apart from anything else. Volunteers can come for one of two parts. So you either come at 9:30 to the centre at St Paul's and get involved with the cooking. This involves a lot of chopping. Sometimes it feels like you've chopped more carrots than you ever wanted to see carrots in your life. But it's always a good group of people. We have quite a lot of young professionals, people from loads of different backgrounds, a lot of students as well. And so there's always good conversation in the kitchen to get you through the chopping. And then we also have volunteers who come from 11:45, and that's to serve the meals. So their role is to eat the food, which is very important, and to sit and have a chat with the guests, which is always interesting, and no 2 weeks will ever be the same because there's so many interesting people that come to the meal. And to do the clearing up afterwards, which again, with a good group of people, it's quite a lot of fun to do it. Yeah, we always need volunteers, especially over the summer when the students go away, and so our numbers do naturally dip. And so if anyone's interested in volunteering, then they can find us online if they go to foodcycle.org.uk and on Twitter and Facebook, and you can find out how to get involved.
Nice one. So with the cooking, obviously you're going to get lots of different types of ingredients with the surplus aspect. How do you normally approach that?
Yeah, it's kind of like a giant game of Ready, Steady, Cook each week, because you have no idea what you're going to get, and the aim is to use up as much of the ingredients as you possibly can so that nothing has to go to waste. There's a few things that we pretty much can always guarantee we're going to have. For example, we always get loads and loads of fresh bread, and we always get heaps of bananas. So we have a few recipes up our sleeve, things like banana bread, bread and butter pudding, often soups with garlic bread or croutons, and we have some old staples that we like to fall back on. But we also like to keep it varied for our guests so they're not having the same things each week. You know, really having such a wide range of volunteers really adds to that. You know, I've learned so many recipes from different people over the years, and you can get together and come up with a meal plan. It's really good fun.
Oh, that sounds like loads of fun. Okay, so food waste is quite clearly a really big problem, and there's all these different organisations trying to tackle it. But how much of it is there?
Food waste is a massive problem. There is a report that was published last year by the Institute for Mechanical Engineers that estimated that up to 50% of all food produced in the world never gets eaten.
50%?
It's really high, and this is down to a number of reasons. One is problems with infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So especially in developing countries and some parts of the world, they just don't have the infrastructure to actually transport and store the food once it's grown and produced, and getting food sort of to the right places. Another big problem is demands put on by supermarkets and consumers. So a lot of food doesn't make it out of the field, such as wonky parsnips and things that don't quite meet the exacting standards that people want to see. And then also you have food that's wasted by supermarkets, which is what we tackle with. And another really big part of food waste is food that gets thrown away in our homes. It's actually one of the biggest causes of food waste. It costs the average family up to £50 a month, which if you times that up over a year, you're looking at about £500, £600 that a family could save just by cutting the amount of food they're throwing away. So food waste as a whole is a massive problem, and there are, as you said, a lot of different initiatives taking place to try and tackle that in lots of different ways. And the brilliant thing about Food Cycle is we're not just talking about change, we're really leading to change, because we're taking something that would be wasted and we're turning it into something good.
Absolutely.
So Food Cycle is a charity. Since it started in 2009, they've cooked over 63,000 meals, which has supported over 3,000 beneficiaries. You know, that's a lot of support to lots of different parts in the country, and that will have saved around 64,000 kilograms of surplus food from going to waste.
Oh my goodness.
So in the grand scheme of things, it's a drop in the ocean, but it's a positive change all the same.
Yeah, exactly. A drop is a drop.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've worked with Love Food, Hate Waste campaign. Tell us more about that.
So the Love Food, Hate Waste campaign is all about helping people to reduce the amount of food that we're throwing away in our homes. Like I said already, we could save a huge amount of money if we threw less food away. And also the environmental impact is huge. I think it's equivalent to taking one in five cars off the road if we all stop producing so much waste.
Wow.
So there's two main reasons that we're throwing away food in our homes. One is that we are cooking and serving too much. So you can tackle this really easy ways by making sure you get your portions right, only putting as much as you can eat on your plate. When you're cooking, especially things like pasta and rice, they're two of the biggest culprits. Measure it out. Find something in the kitchen which is the exact portion of rice, or get a spaghetti measure. You can buy them all over the place. You can even make one if you find a template online. And the second reason that we're wasting so much food is that we're not using it in time. So we will buy stuff that perhaps we don't really or can't really use. We're not storing it in the correct ways to prolong its life. It lurks around in a fruit bowl or in the back of the fridge, and eventually it just gets chucked. So again, solutions to this, really a few really little easy things that people can do. For example, writing a shopping list. It's amazing how many people don't write a shopping list, and that's when you're more likely to get pulled into the special offers and not know what you actually need or what you have in your cupboard, so you might buy things you already have. And another way is to just write a simple meal plan. So work out a few days in advance what you're going to need to eat, plan it out. That way you can do things like batch cooking and freezing some for another day, to having leftovers for your lunch. There's so many little ways, and the impact we can have on the environment if we all reduce our food waste is massive, as well as by saving money.
So in terms of Food Cycle and how it is going now, obviously it's going really well, but how do you see it expanding as a whole organisation, or even just in Cambridge?
As a whole organisation, Food Cycle is definitely going places. It's actually just launched a new approach to starting up new hubs, and so I think in the coming months we're going to see quite a lot of new Food Cycles popping up over the country, which is really exciting. But in Cambridge, there's loads of opportunities. I mean, every Food Cycle operates a little bit differently, but there's more food waste out there, and so there's definitely more we could do in terms of setting up special events to help us with our fundraising. I quite like the idea of doing sort of a monthly student event where everyone just brings a bottle and comes down for a bit of a feast, and maybe we could get some music there. That's inspired by Bristol Food Cycle, who do that already, and it's just another aspect to Food Cycle of bringing people together and using surplus food whilst actually raising some money at the same time. Really, we have a lot of flexibility to make Food Cycle our own in Cambridge. We're all volunteers who run it, and it's brilliant to be able to shape such a great charity on a local area. So if anyone has any bright ideas for how Food Cycle could be even bigger and better, then do get in touch and we'd love to hear them.
Oh, cool. Well, thank you so, so much for speaking to me. It's been great meeting you.
You too. Thank you very much.
And that was Zoe Chambers, who has volunteered for Food Cycle for several years now. As she said, if you want to volunteer, just visit their website, foodcycle.org.uk, and get stuck in. It really does sound like a great deal of fun, and of course you have the added bonus of doing something really positive for the community.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Another support for people who are not able to afford enough food is provided by food banks. I spoke with Ursula Hornatschka at the Church of Our Lady and the English Martyrs, or OLEM, in Hills Road, about the food bank that operates from there and which is supported by the Trussell Trust. Ursula, why do people need to use a food bank?
They need to use a food bank because they are having difficulties with either paying bills, and or they've lost their jobs, they've got a bereavement, or somebody's sick in the family, so their income coming in isn't as great as it has been in the past.
So they can't afford food?
Well, I suppose many people, it's a choice between buying food and perhaps paying their bills. For people to have to come and ask for food is a very demoralising and degrading thing to have to do. It isn't something that people do very lightly.
And then that comes out in the way they approach you, does it?
Well, they don't approach the food bank directly. What they do is they go to agencies like CAB.
What is CAB?
Citizens Advice Bureau. Or specific agencies like Ad Action or Social Services, who assess them, and they get a voucher which they then bring to the distribution centres at the food banks, and they then get a box of food for whatever category, whether they're a single person, a couple, a small family or a large family.
And how long is that food to last them?
The food is for 3 days, and it's a box of food which is tinned and dried goods, so it's non-perishable goods. And it's quite a good box of food that if you are able to cook and know how to use the items well, you can make it last for a week, which is what some people have told us they've been able to do.
After then, though, if you're still not able to afford enough food, what happens then?
I think one of the aspects of the food banks connected with the Trussell Trust is that you're not only looking at food poverty in the client, but also finding a way forward for them to deal with their issues. And often you're signposting them to other agencies to make sure that they're getting the relevant help that they need.
But if the problems are financial, it's you mentioned bereavement.
The bereaved might be the breadwinner, and so it's difficult for the other person. It takes time to sort out their finances and also get their pensions or whatever they're entitled to. So there's a time lapse, really, when they perhaps might not even have any income coming in at all.
And what about people who are earning? Are there many who come to Food Bank who actually do have jobs?
Some people have jobs and they are actually on low incomes, and they might have an extraordinary bill that's come in that they can't pay, so they come and seek help. But I should point out that the majority of people in that situation find it very difficult to go and ask for help.
And how does that reveal itself?
Well, for me personally, it's revealed itself where on an occasion there was this lady who had been to CAB. She had come with her voucher, and she was actually outside one of the distribution centres and looking in, and I saw that there was somebody hovering outside, so I went out to see her, and she said, "Oh, I was hoping there'd be nobody in there and I wouldn't have to come in and face you with this voucher." She was embarrassed and ashamed, and she literally wept when she'd got her box of food. So it's a very moving and it's a very humbling situation. But people have to first of all go to an agency like the Citizens Advice Bureau, and then with their voucher they then have to go to a distribution centre where they're meeting another group of people that they don't know to present a voucher. And usually at the distribution centres people are very welcoming and will offer them a cup of tea or coffee and sit down and a chat. Some people just come in and take their box of food, but others quite welcome sitting down and talking for the whole time that the distribution centre's open. And often there are people there who can signpost that person to another agency that might be able to help them. Mm.
And are numbers increasing? We hear they are.
I believe that they are increasing phenomenally. I know that the local food bank is going through food very rapidly, much more so than last time, and I don't have any figures before me to give you.
But one of the work and pensions ministers, Lord Freud, said it was difficult to know if more people are going to food banks was simply because there are more food banks.
I think there are more food banks because there's a tremendous need for them, otherwise they wouldn't be arising. And people are using them because there is a need.
Mm. If they're given tinned and dried foods, I wonder to what extent that's a properly balanced diet. You know, is the vitamin C going to be in there, the fresh fruit and vegetables?
I think Originally, when the Trust devised this menu, they did take advice from a dietitian and nutritionist at the hospital in Salisbury. So it's been devised with that in mind, and I think it's a fairly broad-based box of food. I quite agree, it would be good to be able to provide fresh fruit and vegetables, but you run into the health and safety factor with that.
Because they're so perishable.
They're so perishable, yeah. And it's storage, and you aren't able to do that as well.
Do you think the price of food is affecting people badly?
Greatly. I think you often see people going round the stores and they are counting their pennies very carefully and then looking at what they are able to buy. And often the comments are that, you know, last week I was able to get this much for, say, £40, but this week I'm not getting as much. And it's very worrying for everybody, particularly people on fixed incomes.
How can people donate food to a food bank?
They can donate food or money to the food bank by looking on their website or telephoning them. There are lots of boxes in, I think, Tesco, Sainsbury's, Waitrose, where you can deposit food. Lots of churches donate on a much regular basis. We here at Olem have a collection the last weekend of every month. But you can usually ring up the number and make an arrangement of delivering food.
The Cambridge food banks need both food and volunteers. The sorts of jobs they have are for drivers, bookkeepers, warehouse staff, people to sort donated food, people to work in one of their five centres meeting their clients and giving out food. And as Ursula just said, you can donate food at a supermarket or at Unit 4 Orwell Furlong, Cambridge, which is opposite the Science Park on Milton Road. It's open from 9.30 till 1 o'clock on Monday and Friday and from 10.30 till 1 o'clock on Tuesday. But it's probably a better idea to look at their website first, where you'll find a list of the sorts of food they need. Or you can give them a ring on 07772 538 628. I'll give that number again in a minute. Finally, I asked Ursula about the effect of food poverty on people.
Difficulties can happen to anybody at any time, and the reality is that most people are just a month's salary away from being in poverty. You've got house payments, car payments, credit card payments. You lose your salary and you're in a mess. Mm. And there's a downward spiral. And it's a horrible situation to be in.
And presumably it will affect the cohesiveness of families, that sort of stress.
Well, it is, and it's incredibly stressful for people in that situation, for partners and for families and for children. So you're looking at a broader picture, and I think what food banks try to do is to help people to restore their dignity and for them to feel that they have someone they can talk to about it in a non-judgmental manner. I think the thing to pose to people who say, you know, people bring it upon themselves or they should be able to manage is for them to see how they would manage in a week with perhaps a pound that's left over from their wage or their benefit, and to try see how they would manage for a week without using a credit card or a checkbook, and it's quite an eye-opener.
I can't even imagine it, actually.
It is quite an eye-opener. Yeah.
Okay, thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much.
And thank you to Ursula from Olem for that. And the telephone number of the Cambridge Food Bank is 07772 538 628. And there are some good ideas on their website of ways of getting involved as well. For example, organising a food collection in your workplace or neighbourhood. But another area where food is wasted is allotments. And I'm sure this is, you know, on a tiny scale compared with what we've been talking about. But allotment holders don't always gather all their produce. Raspberries seem to be prone to being ignored for some reason. And also, of course, there are seasonal gluts. But if you are an allotment holder, you can try and sell your produce to shops. Some independent shops may take them. The farm shop on Lensfield Road does from time to time. You won't make much money out of it, though, but at least it prevents waste. And there is also a feature in today's Guardian money section about ways of selling your produce. Or maybe Food Cycle will be interested.
Weekend coming up or a spare evening? Don't know what to do? You've got the kids whinging at you to go somewhere. And it's driving you mad! Well, why not check out our essential What's On guide on our website, Cambridge105.fm, and see what's happening in this great city. There's ideas for great days out for all the family. So why not go online to Cambridge105.fm and see what's happening in the city this week.
Make hay while the sun shines, and that's certainly been true for ice cream vendors during the recent heat wave. Matt found that one of the longest serving ice cream families in Cambridge lives just a few streets from him, so he went over to pay a visit.
Yeah, the Verrecchia ice cream vans have always featured in the background scenery of my life here in Cambridge, so it was quite unusual to be finally chatting with him, casually in his garden on a hot summer's evening. A bit like chatting to a neighbour, you know, one that you always see but never quite get around to speaking to. And so, another bit of the town and my past is brought into focus. Verrecchia's ice cream is a family tradition. It was established in 1966 by Ivo Verrecchia, drawing on his experience from his Italian background in ice cream retailing. Now today, Verrecchia's has a squadron of vans, ice cream stands and carts all around Cambridge. And I'm talking with Ivo's son, Carlo. Carlo, welcome to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Pleased to meet you, Matthew.
Now, the Italians, they began settling in UK seaside towns in about the 1880s, and Carlo, you were telling me at one point, your father, he moved to Scotland. Now, Scotland's quite far from Cambridge, and as far as I'm aware, there's no seaside areas on the Cambridge borders. So, what brought your father here?
Well, Matthew, my father had his older sister in Cambridge, my Aunt Clara, who ran the coffee mill and a copper kettle, for those of you who remember that far back.
Sorry, these were both cafes, yeah?
Yeah, cafes. One on King's Parade and one on the old Regent Street. And she invited him to come to Cambridge to work in her coffee shop. And thereafter, he decided to buy an ice cream van and became passionate about ice cream. And he got a picture on the back of the King's College with his first soft ice cream van in 1966.
Ah, so now the other factor that was adding to your father's creating Verrecchia's ice cream in the mid-60s was, of course, the rise of the Mr. Whippy van, which had just come onto the scene. That made cheap refrigeration possible, combined with, I think it was a research of a British chemical team, that they developed this method of doubling the amount of air in ice cream, which gives it that lighter Mr. Whippy texture.
Yes, Matthew. The Mr. Whippy is fundamentally a British phenomenon. So the air actually makes it creamier, and hence that's why people relate to Mr. Whippy to be creamy and light. And it's still very, very popular to this day, and it's one of our main sellers.
Now, one thing you were saying just as I turned up here, you haven't seen a hot summer like this since 2003, was it?
2003, yeah. People talk of 1976 too. But the summer started in March and ended in October, so it was one of those one-off summers.
One long hot summer, yeah.
Exactly.
Now, as you said, Ivo introduced his first soft ice cream van to the backs of Cambridge King's College, Queen's Road. But you also have a very sizable kiosk on Jesus Green.
Yes, that's let from the Cambridge City Council. We've been there since 20 years going backwards. And we serve cappuccinos, our quality dairy scoop ice cream, which is very popular, and also the Mr. Whippies. Yeah, that's one of the most busiest ice cream sites in Cambridge, and on the hot days like this, the river's completely packed with people, so that's what we wait for, really.
I understand you sell about 50 to 60 varieties of ice cream, and now this ranges from your popular flavours such as strawberry, vanilla and chocolate, to something more unusual like the coconut, pistachio and mint. You also have things like Cheeky Monkey, which is a banana ice cream with pistachio.
Yes, at our Jesus Green kiosk, we try to keep our customers interested. Our ice cream is absolutely natural ice cream, no additives or preservatives. And we try to introduce a new flavour every month, so it's just to keep the people interested in the flavours. At the moment, what's going good is pistachio, honeycomb and caramel. We've got things like Turkish Delight also. But you can't beat our signature ice cream, Clotted Cream Vanilla. That's the absolutely best vanilla in Cambridge. And also the popular ones are like strawberries and cream and chunky chocolate. They're the best sellers, really.
And of course, you also cater for people with diabetic issues as well. You do your vanilla, strawberry ripple and forest ripple flavours, yes?
Yes, indeed. We try to cater for all tastes and all customers' needs. If a customer has a particular requirement, we certainly go the extra mile to actually serve these particular tastes.
Now, the Verrecchia family also have a long history in contract catering. You have a 5-star catering award, and you serve from professional purpose-built units, marquees and gazebos, from comprehensive menus that suit all tastes, events and seasons. I understand that you moved into the contract catering side back in the 80s. What was it that prompted the move for you?
Well, ice cream is so weather dependent, it was natural to actually diversify into catering. And also many people, contract caterers or many event organisers, would ask me, am I able to cater something else? Because then you're using one person who's actually one-stop caterer to actually supply the ice cream and all the various outdoor foods for their events. So it's seen an actual progression, and since then we've gone up and up, and now we're one of the main caterers at University Balls, and we have a full catering menu for all outdoor events.
So with all of these events that you've catered for and are still catering for, have you got any good anecdotes for us on that?
Well, certainly, Matthew. I've served an array of different people, and Stephen Hawkins, about 20 years ago, as we were serving soft ice cream from our ice cream van every Sunday, he would walk in with his young son, and Stephen Hawkins would treat him to a soft ice cream. And another memory I have is Prince Edward, who was a student in Cambridge, and he approached me at one of these events. And he came up, and I just remember this vividly, and I was thinking, should I charge him? And the thought came across my mind, he just came up and said, strawberry ice cream, and I gave him it, and I've just wavered the charge. Would you have done that, Matthew?
I'd like to think I'd have asked him for the cash.
Well, there you are, it was a tricky one, but it was a memory.
And linking tenuously to memory, one thing that I tend to ask people is, do they have any future plans? Now, when we were chatting about this the other night, you mentioned that you get lots of ideas, lots of perhaps rather modern ideas on the catering side from the students themselves at the May Balls. Is that true?
Yes, indeed. It's very challenging to cater at the May Balls because the students have such a high standard and they have a very vivid concept of what they require regarding catering. So we gain a lot of experience and lots of ideas from the students. Other than that, on my worldly travels, we were constantly looking out of ideas and catering ideas. And through our recent visit to Japan, we're thinking about introducing wasabi ice cream and green tea ice cream, which was very popular in Japan. So we constantly have to keep on searching for ideas to keep our customers interested.
So you're very diverse and international, aren't you, in your scope?
Well, you have to be, and Verrecchia's been here since 1966, and we're very much a family business. All my brothers, my nephews, and my wife, we all help out in the business, and hopefully we're going to be here for another at least 20 years, Matthew.
Good, I hope so too. Well, Carlo, thanks so very much for chatting to me. You can find out more about Verrecchia's ices and contract catering via their respective websites at Verrecchia, and I will spell that verrecchia-icecream.co.uk, and for their catering side, verrecchia-catering.co.uk. And don't worry if you didn't catch that, we will provide full links on our podcast page accompanying this episode. So thanks very much, Carlo, once again, and you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Thank you for having me, Matthew.
And you can find the Verrecchia vans at school fetes, corporate events and the Lodestar Festival at the end of August.
Yeah, I really like the natural progression of things with Carlo, as I do in all avenues where one thing tends to lend itself to another. Yes, he sells ice cream, but the climate here necessitated diversification. In his case, he moved into contract catering, and it's really blossomed for them. And the same is true of an ice cream company, Tamar, who I was reading about prior to this interview. With them, it was an overproduction of milk in the 1980s that led the government to introduce the quota system. Tamar saw an opportunity there to take that overproduction and turn it into ice cream. That is their business now, and they work in close collaboration with Verrecchia's. Lovely ice cream made of fresh milk, double cream and sugar. So, you know, why not try an unusual flavour down at Verrecchia's kiosk on Jesus Green today? Like banana ice cream with pistachios or a rhubarb and ginger crumble. They introduce a new flavour every month.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Regular listeners really cannot fail to be impressed by our wine critic Tom Lewis's descriptions of wines. His use of words is positively poetic. But always on the lookout for a better way to describe wines, Tom has recently taken to comparing them to people. Now a further development, comparing wines with music. Has it been done before? I don't know. I doubt it. but it really works. Tom, we're going to talk about wine and music analogies. And by that, we mean using a piece of music to sum up what a wine is like.
Yep, exactly.
But why music analogies? Why analogies?
I think the reason for that is it can be quite difficult to describe a wine just by writing about it. It would be like trying to describe a painting to someone who's never seen it. And if it was a painting, it would be an abstract one at that. So I can show you a picture of the painting, even if I can't show you the original. But with a wine, when I describe it, there's no way that I can allow you to experience the same thing as what it tastes like. I've only got words to describe it. So for me, analogies are helpful in giving a sense of, you know, what is this wine like overall, not just a description of the individual parts.
Okay, but why do you think music works?
I don't know, really. I use a lot of analogies when I'm writing, and what I do is I try and think of something that sums up the wine overall in a number of ways. As it could be a person, it could be a thing, it could be a piece of music. And what I'm trying to do is give something that creates an overall impression of what that wine is like.
Right. And the musical analogies come to you more easily than other analogies, do they?
To an extent, yes. I think it's where one's interests are. There are also similarities in the language that we use to describe wine and music.
Right. In what way? Could you give some examples or
for sure,
explain
yeah.
a bit more?
I mean, for me, it's a very personal thing, but I find the structure of a wine and a piece of music, there are distinct parallels. So if I take the example of something like a rock band or a symphony orchestra that you might listen to, there are the structural underpinnings, and by that I mean the deep notes, so the drums and the bass, and to me that's what's holding the music together, and you feel these as much as hearing them. Now above that, you've then got things like the melodies and the harmonies. These are easy to enjoy, they're immediately noticeable aspects. So if we think about a wine, it has the same thing. It has the structural underpinnings, which I think of as the tannins and the acidity, and then the fruit flavours are something on top.
OK. Remind us what you mean by, or how we detect tannins and acidity.
Well, tannins are, in red wine, they're the sort of bitter, mouth-drying elements, and they come from the skins and the pips. So if you have too much tannin in a wine, it'll taste like stewed tea with no milk, that sort of bitter, mouth-drying sense. And that's actually why we put milk in strong tea, because the fat and the sweetness of the milk balance off the bitterness of the tannins in the tea. The acidity is just simply the freshness of a wine. If it's got too little, it'll feel a bit flabby and blousy, and if it's got too much, it's going to be piercingly fresh, like really freshly squeezed lemon juice.
Right, before we go on, flabby and blousy.
Flabby and blousy, yes, more analogies. Exactly. I mean, if a wine doesn't have enough acidity, it just feels flabby and blousy.
Okay, right.
I think the final thing we talked about is a fruit, and that's exactly that. It's, you know, those pleasing fruit flavours that you immediately notice. So, you know, in an example of fairly typical wines, Riesling tastes of lemon and lime. Sauvignon Blanc tastes of gooseberries, Cabernet Sauvignon blackcurrant, and a Syrah is sort of elderberries and dried plums.
Right, so your analogies are going to be more than just a simple comparison or a clever play on words.
Yes, and what I'm trying to do, as I said, is really find something that sums up the impression of what that wine is, you know, what it feels like overall, rather than just a listing out a series of descriptions.
OK, well, let's try one and see if it works.
Hopefully it will.
Yeah.
So my first one is Riesling. Now, just to quickly summarise the wine, or the style, it's originally from Germany. You can also find it in Alsace, Austria and New Zealand. It's a white wine, its characteristics are it has quite high acidity, and the fruit is, as I've said, mainly lemon and lime, citrus and freshness. But it's not a completely light wine, it has a weighty minerality to it. So as a wine, I'd describe it as it's more challenging than some. It's energetic, it's quite thrilling, it's angular, it's sort of in your face.
And the music would be?
Well, the music to describe a wine like this, to me, is the Rolling Stones. And the particular piece that really sums it up, I think, is Jumping Jack Flash.
Watch it.
So that's the Rolling Stones, and to me they're basically a blues rock band, and they've always been true to that. They're energetic and in your face. They're not trying to please. There's no softness there. If you think of someone like Mick Jagger, you know, he's, when he performs, he's skinny, he's all knees and elbows. And the sound of the Rolling Stones is never big and produced. It's instantly recognisable. So it's a classic benchmark.
Right, so that's the benchmark for Riesling.
For
okay,
Riesling.
Let's turn the Rolling Stones off. What's next?
Well, within white wines, the two great varieties are Riesling and Chardonnay, so we have to do Chardonnay next.
Okay.
And for Chardonnay, it is a very versatile grape, but I'm thinking here of that sort of ripe, oaky Chardonnay, the sort that was really popular in the 90s. You probably had it at lots of dinner parties that you went to. And for that style of Chardonnay, the thing that's really key to its flavour is the oaking, the way that the wine is matured in oak barrels, usually new oak. And so a lot of its character comes from the way that it reacts with the wood. So new oak is going to give a Chardonnay flavours of sweet vanilla, oatmeal-y butteriness. And the oak is toasted, and that is, it's charred, it's burnt on the inside by the cooper. So you'll get varying degrees of toastiness in the wine as well. You'll get what we call leesiness from the barrel ageing, and that's the flavour of the lees, which are the dead yeast cells that the wine sits on for an extended period. If you add into that finally the sort of naturally ripe citrusy fruit and sharp acidity that you get, that's your oaky Chardonnay.
And where would that be from?
Well, for me, the benchmark style for that is Burgundy, and Meursault is the home of big Chardonnays. But it's a style that's conquered the world. Australia, California have made it famous. You also find it elsewhere in the New World. New Zealand, Chile, South Africa. There's very few places where you can't get it, actually.
Right, so oaky Chardonnay has ripe citrus fruit, sweet vanilla, toastiness, buttery oatmeal and creamy Brazil nuts. Leesiness, the flavour of the yeast, and a sharp acidity. So I'm struggling with the musical,
musical analogy. There's a lot in there. And that's exactly sort of the challenge. But to me, it has to be the Beatles. And the reasons for that are numerous. I mean, just as the Beatles and the Stones were the two greats, but very different in what they do, Chardonnay and Riesling are the two greats of wine.
OK, but there's more to it than that?
Well, there is. The next level is that with the Beatles, the complexity comes not from their energy, as we saw with the Rolling Stones, but from their production methods. You know, you listen to a Beatles track and it's instantly likeable and versatile.
OK, let's hear some. Love is all you need. 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 Love is all you need.
As we can hear there, that was the end of All You Need Is Love. And the Beatles retreated into the studio and focused on production techniques. So listen to that. There's layers of sound. There's whole lots of things going on. And that's where the complexity in this song is coming from. It's from the layering and the contrast that they create through the juxtaposition. There are all sorts of bits going on there. If you took one element on its own, it would be pleasant enough and bland. Two would probably be quite interesting, but three or four or five, and that's where the complexity is coming from.
I think that really works, actually, because the complexity in that music and, you know, your description of the complexity of the Chardonnay, I can see that exactly.
Good.
And that was Tom Lewis with his description of Riesling and Chardonnay, an approach that really makes sense to me. And Tom will be back on the next programme with some more wine and music analogies.
Hello, this is Neil Whiteside. Join me weekday mornings between 7 and 9.30 for 105 Breakfast, where we'll play the best music and some decent chat to get you up, dressed and out the door, preferably with a smile on your face. I'll have just a second, your chance to see if you can spot the intro to a record, the latest news, the what's ons, and half an hour of classic oldies between 9 and 9.30 in Too Good To Be Forgotten. All that and a different co-host every morning. That's me, Neil Whiteside, and somebody else every weekday morning between 7 and 9.30 here on Cambridge 105. Community radio in your city.
And now over to Alan with his look at food articles in today's newspapers.
Today's Financial Times magazine is a celebration of visual culture. It's got, well, it's fascinating, and it's got lots of very attractive images covering complex data visualization in finance and science through to art, architecture, street art. But the food section is not separate from this. The impact of visual display continues here too. So, for example, Jancis Robinson's wine column has a large visual showing the family trees of several grapes. It's been worked out from analysis of grape DNA and shows how ultimately Cabernet Sauvignon and the Pinot Noir grape are related. Nicholas Lander's column is about the art of the menu, so there's some really nice old, and in fact some more recent menus there, but they all look good. They all display the items in an attractive and interesting way. Rowley Lee's recipe is illustrated by a comic strip. I think the Financial Times magazine is by some way the most interesting and well-written of the Saturday papers, but this one is exceptionally good. The Guardian's magazine is mostly devoted to food. It begins with barbecues, continues with salads, then on to summer ices, and there's a section by Paul Hollywood on summer baking, and finally a few pages of summer cocktails and mocktails. And if that isn't enough, there's the cook supplement. This, too, is a special edition focusing on recipes for children. So there's a quick overview.
So did anything catch your eye in particular, then?
Well, Rowley Lee's piece in the Financial Times is interesting. He writes about Len Dayton, the author, who in the 1960s produced cook strips, illustrated recipes, and they ran as a column in The Observer and were published by Penguin. Rowley Lee says he's unaware that anyone else has used the idea, well, until now. Christophe Blaine, a French graphic novelist, has worked with a chef to produce In the Kitchen with Alain Passard. Rowley Lee decided to ask Christophe to illustrate one of his recipes, but to do so, he had to film himself making it and explain what he does, what he was doing in French, because Christophe speaks little English. So here in the Financial Times is a comic strip on how to make country pâté. It's in French, though, but Rowley Lee gives the recipe in English, too, and he says the result is inimitable and almost impossible to buy. It will have a freshness and a juiciness rarely found in shop-bought pâté.
What's in it?
Well, it is quite robust. Belly of pork, pork back fat, brandy, thyme, juniper berries, chicken livers, 6 cloves of garlic, pancetta. Do you like the sound of it?
I really do, minus the liver part, but that's pretty essential for pâté.
Yeah, right. Well, he says, I promise that the moment you cut a slice, you will see yourself in a cafe inhabited by old codgers with berets, the air thick with the smell of gitan, sitting at a table with a baguette and a litre jug of rough country wine. It makes me want to go to France immediately. And actually, a friend sent me an email from France this morning of his meal last night, which was duck in elderberry sauce. Let's have a look at these summer food ideas in The Guardian. It begins with Hugh Fernie Whittingstall's barbecue suggestions. Lamb and apricot kebabs with spiced yoghurt appealed to me, not least because the apricots this year are the best I think I've ever bought. Well, they are from Lynn's Serve Yourself stall in the market anyway. There's also a recipe for barbecued sea bass over bay leaves. You use 6 small branches of bay, or rosemary if you haven't got the bay, and as they burn on the barbecue, the perfume smoke penetrates deep into the fish.
Bay's becoming a fashionable ingredient, yes? Wasn't there an ottolenghi recipe with bay leaves recently?
Yes, there was. Buttermilk and bay leaf pie, which actually I made, and it really was excellent.
Any barbecue desserts?
Yeah, there's barbecued peach melba. You can use peaches or nectarines, and I must say that the flat nectarines, again from Lynn's Market Stall, have been exceptional this year. But this looks to need something bigger, something thicker, so I think the conventional nectarines or peaches would do.
Okay, and how about salad?
Some lovely-looking ones. Tomato and roasted lemon salads. The salads are all by Yotam Ottolenghi, by the way. Smoked mackerel and pickled walnut. And as with the barbecue recipes, Fiona Beckett provides wine or beer suggestions. Elsewhere, Paul Hollywood has a clafoutis, which looks fantastic, and a summer fruit genoise, which also looks marvellous. And again, Fiona Beckett provides suggestions for the wines. And finally, some cocktails, cucumber and basil martini, and some non-alcoholic ones, mocktails, beetroot and lime water, and I can't fail to mention the elderflower lemonade. Delicious.
All right, thanks very much, Alan. Now, before we draw to a close, I'd like to tell you a little bit about our programme's origin. Flavour began in July 2007. Back then, it was a monthly show called, aptly enough, Flavour of the Month. The creator and the producer was Elaine Kuzak, a cheese-loving Geordie music journalist and community radio enthusiast who, whilst running a hospital radio in Hammersmith, tuned into Cambridge 105 via the internet, relocated here, and began this programme. Elaine left Flavour in early 2009 to move up north and marry her husband, Simon, a man who was addicted to bourbon biscuits. She still listens in every now and again, and she feels that buzz of elation every time she hears our Flavour theme tune, the tune that's been accompanying this programme since its inception. I bumped into her again recently. She's written a book called Allotments Number 1, and it contains a poem based on her time on an allotment near the Arbury. It's a celebration of nature, people, physical graft, and flasks of tea. Here's a poem from her book. It's called Rectangle of Hope. Modern life comes ready sliced and vacuum-packed, compartmentalised by computers into bite-sized portions of family, friends, work, hobbies, which we nibble at rather than swallow whole. Slicing experience into small segments makes us forget our unique role in this world. Come with me to the allotments and observe life's potential explored in slim strips of soil. Compare and contrast my plot with those either side, looked after by Charlie and his mate Jim. They've been coming here 3 times a week for years. I'll never match their productivity, but I don't care. I'm not here to measure myself against retired men with time on their hands. That's not the point of renting an allotment. I want to learn from my mistakes. I want to have a laugh. Ha! That sounds like the reason we're on this earth, rasped throaty Val from the plot opposite mine when I visited the site for the first time one Sunday morning late last February. Val insisted on sharing her flask of tea as she talked with me, and she used cigarettes to emphasise her opinion of Charlie, Jim, and the rest of the allotment committee. I leave politics at the allotment gate. I prefer digging, planting, and bird-watching. I come here at the weekends and weekday evenings to fertilise my soul and photosynthesise. What will you do with your rectangle of hope? Get muddy enjoying your second childhood? Pick gooseberries, then eat them as you clean your tools? Stand tall and proud, admiring your creation.
Elaine now performs her poetry regularly in Tyne and Wear and runs a bookstall in Tynemouth Market on the weekends. The poem, Rectangle of Hope, features in her book, Allotments Number 1. Every copy of the book is unique and hand-stitched. You can purchase one for £10 via the email warkworthbooks, that's W-A-R-K-W-O-R-T-H, books, I hope you know how to spell that, at hotmail.com.
I do.
And we'll provide a link to her blog on our podcast page.
Right. I used to work in Tynemouth, actually. Cambridge allotments have featured in a previous episode on Flavour, so we've dealt with allotments as well. And that's the 13th of October last year, where I interviewed Declan O'Halloran of Cambridge City Council about the waiting list for plots and what's being done to create more. If you'd like to hear more about that, and indeed the variety of things we cover on this programme, each Flavour podcast page contains a detailed episode stretching back to January 2012, and every episode is a single click away.
Now, once more, we must call time on yet another episode of Flavour. We'd like to say thank you to all of our interviewees. Brian of the Farm Shop on Lensfield Road, Carlo Varecchia of Varecchia's Ice Cream and Catering, Zoe Chambers of the Food Cycle Scheme, Ursula Hojnatska of the Church of Our Lady and the English Martyrs on Hills Road, and Cambridge wine blogger Tom Lewis, of course.
And don't forget to follow Flavour on Twitter at Flavour105. That's where you'll read about the news we discover ourselves, and we also retweet food and drink stories from other Cambridge sources. We brought you news of the rather dramatic closure of Café Julien recently and the closure of Massaro's, both on Regent Street, though we hear Massaro's might be a temporary closure. Let's wait and see. The next live edition will be on Saturday the 10th of August at midday, and you can find our previous episodes on our podcast page on the Cambridge 105 website.
So do join us again next time. Coming up next is George hosting a special edition of Saturday Lunch. Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.